Are you okay?
Yeah, that was my my spooky voice.
Was it?
Well, I was trying my spooky evil laugh.
Is that going to happen all episode? Or?
Well, I figured I'd just get in the spirit of things. We're doing The Supernatural this week.
We are. Yeah. What season of Supernatural do you most enjoy, James?
Well, I think the earlier seasons. No. That's that's not what we're doing. We're sorry to disappoint if you were tuning in because we said last week we're doing Supernatural. We're not doing the TV show.
Part of me honestly hopes there's someone listening wearing the Supernatural t-shirt, holding a little Funko Pop of Dean or something and like getting so excited about us talking about their favoritest TV show ever. And we're not.
We're not.
We're not.
You have this grand image of what you're hoping. Yeah. I'm just hoping somebody's listening. Full stop. Somebody's listening. I don't care if they're wearing a Supernatural shirt or not. I'm just imagining there's a Venn diagram. There's a possibility that the Venn diagram of people wearing Supernatural shirts and people listening to our podcast just doesn't overlap.
You're after that overlap? Yeah. That's that key market, James, that we've never been able to tap into.
Supernatural shirt wearing people.
If you are wearing a Supernatural shirt and you do listen to this podcast, please write in and let us know.
Thank you.
There's a prize.
Maybe.
Maybe.
A pat on the back.
We'll give you a shout out next week.
Yeah.
How about that?
Sure, we will.
We should start doing shout outs to anyone that...
No.
That's dangerous, actually. That's dangerous territory. Yeah.
Welcome to Are You Convinced?
Are we starting? Is that the official start?
Good. We're into it. Just so everybody knows, you are listening to Are You Convinced? Episode 6. Let's talk the supernatural. All things supernatural. We are heading into Halloween as the end of October every year.
Can I be really honest with you, James?
I would hope you would be most of the time.
Always. Yeah. Okay.
A lie.
I get what you did there. I like that. That was good. Growing up in Australia, Halloween is something I've really only been exposed to, I reckon, in the last decade.
Yeah.
Yep. I would say. I mean, we started, you and I have been to Halloween parties with friends since we were, 18?
Thereabouts,
So longer than a decade.
Late high school, yeah.
Yeah.
Early adulthood.
And even then, there was almost sort of a tackiness to it that everyone was super aware of. Like, this is a really fun reason to have a party. It wasn't a mainstay institution back then. It was more like a, let's have a Halloween party. How fun is that?
We're embracing American culture.
Yeah. But to me, there was an element of tongue-in-cheek and self-awareness around it. Now, I almost feel like Halloween is nowhere near what it is in the States.
Oh, definitely.
But I certainly do think it's something that, firstly, every Australian is aware of, which I would go as far to say as 20 years ago, we were not. I reckon there's a whole generation of Australians that are not aware of it.
For sure, yeah. And it's funny, like a lot of people will say, why do we have to celebrate Halloween?
Why
do we have to do everything that America does? And, I bring this up. It's fascinating. You get a lot of people like, it celebrates the occult and it's all about witchcraft and, black magic.
Yeah.
Well, people really, really misunderstand what Halloween is.
Well, firstly, because there's such dynamic and powerful forces in our world, aren't they? We should seek to avoid them. But anyway.
Not encourage them. But Halloween has a very interesting history. It's a very sort of religious kind of holiday.
Okay.
It did sort of start as kind of a pagan thing. I think the end of October was actually sort of the start of the new pagan year.
That makes sense.
And it was the time that they believed the veil between life and death was at its thinnest.
Ooh.
So they would have these big celebrations to mark the end of the harvest and to sort of ward off these evil spirits that might be trying to break through.
So to celebrate that, they all went to the nearest Walmart and bought cheap masks and superhero costumes.
Oh, definitely.
This is making a lot of
sense.
Pagan
Walmart, yeah.
Yep. Pagan Walmart.
And I think it was probably about the 17th century. Don't quote me on that. But around the 17th century, it sort of got merged with another celebration, which was on the 1st of November, All Saints Day.
Yes.
Which is all that is holy, is essentially what it was. It was it was Hallowmas. The mass of all that is holy, or the mass of the holy. And so Halloween, being the day before Hallowmas, was All Hallows' Eve. Eve of all that is holy. So from All Hallows' Eve, we got Halloween.
Brilliant. Okay. All right, yeah.
And the Makes idea sense. Was that people would put on masks and mock the evil spirits.
Right.
Make fun of them. to sort of, you know, we're not afraid of you.
Interesting. Okay. And then from like I joked about before, that somehow turned into a multi-billion dollar industry with pumpkin carving and scary costumes. And
well, apparently the idea, people would start playing pranks as part of Halloween. I don't know why necessarily pranks, but that just became an element of it. And it got to the point they'd wear masks to protect their identity while they're pulling these pranks. And these kids would go to doors and they'd say, trick or treat. That was a threat. It was
It is a threat, isn't it?
You give me a treat or we're going to play a trick on you.
That's totally lost on today's generation. So, it's such a nice thing which now means give me overpriced lollies. But in reality, it's I'm accosting you at your door to give me something delicious or I'm going to put toilet paper all across your front yard.
Yeah. So wow. that's gradually evolved to the kids were then encouraged, rather than go out and cause trouble, go knock on doors and appropriate candy.
harass your neighbors. Because if you're going to harass anyone, do it close to home. Yeah. And everyone will just accept it because the veil between living and dead is really thin and demons could just walk into our world at any moment.
So let's go get candy from the neighbors.
Let's just go get candy from neighbors. Maybe I'm distorting this a little bit now in my oversimplification.
I think that's essentially how I guess we've got to where we are now. It's been adapted and distorted a little bit, and gradually we have the Halloween that we have now, which I think people should just embrace. Things come from different places all around the world, and you shouldn't be all hung up on, oh, we shouldn't do what the Americans do. Well, you know what? Just have some fun. It's a good bit of fun.
And why not have a bit of fun? Yeah. Who's it hurting? It's not offending anyone if Australians do Halloween, I suppose.
Not really.
Yeah, no. It's all a bit of fun and a bit of mischief making.
But yeah, so a lot of different elements have sort of come together, and there is a certain element of the occult and the black magic. It's a death and that sort of thing, ghosts and vampires and all things supernatural.
Ooh.
You see the segue I'm going. Where are we going?
Yeah, here? Dean and Castiel. And the other brother whose name always escapes me.
No, so we wanted to talk off the back of Halloween. We wanted to talk about the supernatural, the unexplained things that... Well, supernatural is essentially occurrences, events, happenings that just don't have sort of a scientific, logical explanation, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Could just be various stories told over time that people... I guess there's an element of, do people just see things because there's a story there?
I'm sure there is. I mean, if you were to say to someone, my house is haunted, before they come to the house, they'll see a ghost, you know, or they'll hear a noise
or a
light will flicker or something because once it's in the back of their mind, they won't. It's the power of suggestion. But yeah, a little bit skeptic. I do think a lot of it's down the power of suggestion.
And, yeah, okay.
We've got a couple of things written down here to start with.
Some just sort of supernatural, creepy stories, I guess, to get us in the mood.
Yeah. Can I tell you about one that I discovered recently that happened in our part of the world? This family in Melbourne. It's an amazing story. Basically, to boil it really short, one day the whole family just got in their car and left home. They just fled.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I know, yeah, okay.
Is I'll that
make,
the story?
Hang on, I'll make that more exciting. Are you convinced, James? No, I'll make that a bit more exciting. They, the stories, because they were all found. They're all found alive and well.
Okay.
But no one in the family can fully explain why they left. The kids started to notice that mum and dad started to become more and more erratic and more paranoid. And they were basically convinced that someone or something was after them, that they were not welcome within their own home, that they were... being pursued. No one was after them. They didn't owe any money. They were all paid up on the farm, the house repayments and everything. They had no underworld dealings or anything like that. And then one day, the whole family, with very minimal possessions, just got in their car and just started driving north. What boils down to is no one has been able to really satisfactorily explain what gave them this feeling of dread and unease. They just decided whatever was going on in their world, they had to get away from it. Mum and dad were the instigators. You can interview them now. They were found in quite distressed states. Mum was found nearly catatonic in the back of the ute. And dad wasn't found until a couple of, maybe even up to a week later, I want to say. I was researching this during the week. I think it was mum or the daughter even stole a car. Like such was their urgency to get away and keep moving and to just keep escaping. Yeah. The best they can decide was that it was a... folie à deux is what it's called in scientific. It's a French word. I've butchered it, but it basically means the folly of two. You typically find it with couples, married couples or fiancés who both endure the same sort of stress-induced hallucinations or paranoia. So you can imagine that you're living very closely with someone and you both start putting seeds of paranoia in each other, just in little things, born out of a mutual stress. And then eventually that's where you end up finding people that just sell all the possessions on Gumtree and piss off overseas without a word of anything. They just sort of enforce each other's paranoia. And they reckon that's what happened across a whole family in this case.
Wow.
Yeah. Just bizarre, isn't it? Yeah. But it still doesn't explain what...
happened? Yeah. Is there a supernatural element? Was there some sort of ghost or some sort of spirit?
As a skeptic, I immediately say no. but that doesn't mean that it's not an interesting story.
Oh,
and that doesn't say that I know what caused it.
Exactly.
I don't know what caused it, and I find that fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting. What just makes a whole family of four get so uncomfortable in their own safe home that they just get in a car and drive for 5 days and then separate and get found in bizarre states further up the coast? It's just odd. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you say it's fascinating. Something sort of a story I find fascinating, it seems to come up like through Facebook and whatever quite constantly, is the story of the expressionist.
See, you say all that, but I've never heard of this.
Okay.
I heard of it was you telling me about it during the week.
Yeah, well, I'm a skeptic, but it's a story that fascinates me.
Hmm.
Basically, there was this, I think it's a woman that was found in a really distressed state, just found in the middle of nowhere. She was taken to the hospital and they couldn't ID her. She didn't have fingerprints. She didn't have teeth.
I love any story that starts with she could not or he could not be identified properly. Immediately go, oh, where are they from? Who are they? What were they doing there? No one in this world is unidentifiable.
Yeah, exactly.
Teeth.
So, and
fingerprints.
There's
Blockbuster card. Who has a Blockbuster card?
Nobody knows who she is, who she was. And so they took her to the hospital. Apparently she sat bolt upright. She started getting really agitated, really angry. And the nurses had to hold her down. Can't remember the story exactly, whether they say her head actually twisted around. Twisted around. She's bolt upright on the hospital bed. They're trying to hold her down. They couldn't do it. She hadn't said anything. But suddenly in this loud, booming voice, she says, I am God.
Wow.
And then at some point, she got out of her bed, left, and they never saw her again. And there's this creepy photo that goes with the story, and she looks sort of like Michael Jackson post Jillian operation.
She looks like she's wearing, the one you sent me, she almost looks like a waxwork dummy of an anime character.
It's huge
expressionless eyes and perfectly smooth skin.
I mean, maybe the story, of course, the story could be made up, and maybe the photo has just been found and attributed, attached to the story as a way to illustrate it. But it's just something that sort of always, it comes up in my news feed and it just fascinates me.
It's terrifying, isn't it? And again, it's same sort of thing. It's almost a case of the story is better than the truth.
Yeah.
As long as you're not walking around claiming it is gospel.
But yeah, you want to know, I mean, imagine being in that situation.
Oh my
God!
Where
this patient sits bolt upright, and in this voice that just seems completely unnatural says, "I am
God." Yeah, wow.
You'd freak the hell out.
I'd probably hold out my hand and go, "I'm Damon. Nice to meet you, Mr. God."
It's been a long time coming. I have a few complaints.
I've also got a pen and paper ready. Can you make any suggestions? What should I start doing that I haven't been? You know.
Please advise. have you had any sort of eerie supernatural experiences yourself?
No.
No?
No, I'm so sorry.
No,
I
that's
really
okay.
This is bad radio. It's bad podcasting. I really wish there was one.
Go on.
I'm fairly convinced it's a dream. I'll just tell the story. I remember waking up one night in my family home. And I couldn't get back to sleep. And I remember rolling over and seeing someone standing in my room. And I've looked up and I thought it was my sister. I've got two sisters and I thought it was the elder of the two. I remember going, what are you doing in my room? All this person has done. And it was sort of like a shimmering, almost like the VHS tape had the tracking wrong. If that makes sense. The signal wasn't clear. The image wasn't clear. And it was sort of ghosty. Ghosty. All this figure did is just sort of raise its arms out a little bit and just sort of wave one hand over me, and I went back to sleep again. And then I'd wake up again and she'd either be there or not there. And, you know, and I look at that now as a grown up and I just think, I was dreaming. I was dreaming. Or I've woken up and I've seen a trick of the light in my room from, the blinds moving and the shadows moving in my room.
That's always it. Sometimes, like, I'm sure I've had this a gajillion times where I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'll look across the room and I'll see a figure standing there.
Yeah.
I'm like,
that is 100% an axe murderer.
And then you kind of, your eyes adapt and you see that it's your coat that you've hung up on the door that you didn't. Yep. And you're just like, of course that's what it was.
Of course my coat's the axe murderer.
Yeah.
Wait, hang on. That doesn't make any sense. Of course it's an axe murderer. Yeah. Oh, no. Run. Yeah.
It's obviously just, lights or shadows and just the way it sits. And you just spend forever just sitting there staring are you going to kill me or are you just a jacket on a...
Billy Connolly. Can I tell you a real quick Billy Connolly joke?
He's my hero,
but it's on this topic. It's on the power of suggestion. He talks about he owns this huge mansion in Scotland. And whenever, usually Americans, when they come and visit him, they don't want to stay in the guest bedroom. They want to stay in the tower.
Okay.
So they end up rolling out a sleeping bag and making up a bed. And the first night they stay there, how was it? How'd you sleep? Oh, great, Billy. Slept like a champ, you know. Oh, good, good. You know, I'm glad you said that. Just because a lot of guests say they can't sleep up there, some sort of some bloody presence or something. I don't understand a word of what they're saying. That night, they don't sleep a wink.
Oh, wow, yeah.
The next morning, that thing you talked about, I looked over the grounds and there was a specter walking across them. There were headless horsemen charging across the grounds.
So, I'm actually going to go off the back of that and dive into my topic because
you
mentioned haunted mansions. I'm talking about the LaLaurie. I'm probably saying that wrong. LaLaurie Mansion.
LaLaurie. Well, there's this is from New Orleans.
New Orleans, yes. Yeah. So
LaLaurie,
actually a place I've been to earlier this year.
Cool.
Stood outside of this very mansion. So some of the stuff that I'm telling you is stuff that's been recounted to me. So this mansion was built in 1832. It's located at 1140 Royal Street in the French Quarter of New Orleans. And New Orleans, they have a number of ghost stories, but this mansion is considered by many to be the most haunted location in the city, if not America.
Oh, wow.
So I want to warn people, I would love for you to keep listening, but my story does involve some pretty horrific elements. So if that's not your thing, maybe just skip ahead. Damon's argument might be a little bit lighter. I don't know.
All I'm thinking is, wow, we've never had to give a warning.
Yeah. This
is the first time. We try to keep our language clean. We try to keep the content sort of kid friendly. This is a first for us.
It's pretty horrific, some of the stuff I'm going to talk about. So
I can't wait.
Yeah. Well, let's get into it. So the mansion was owned by Madame Delphine LaLaurie. She was born in New Orleans around 1780s as Marie Delphine McCarthy. She was a socialite whose parties were famous among the city's upper class. She was married three times, and her third husband was a surgeon named Leonard Louis Nicholas LaLaurie. And he was actually much younger than she was. Now, make of this what you will, probably that mostly I haven't done my research well enough.
That's usually what I make out of these arguments.
Both of Delphine's first two marriages ended as a result of the husband's death, and I could not find specifically what they died from.
Oh, no.
I have nothing. I could not find
how they died. I'm going to turn the lights in this room back on now. I'm not comfortable with candlelight.
So, Delphine married Leonard LaLaurie in 1925, and in 1931, she bought the land at 1140 Royal Street and had the mansion constructed there, complete with slave quarters. Oh, so,
of course they did.
This is an incredibly lavish three-story mansion. There's delicate ironwork, there's hand-carved mahogany doors, gigantic chandeliers. This mansion was made for entertaining, and this is where she lived with her husband and two of her daughters, maintaining a key position in New Orleans society. So LaLaurie would host these extravagant parties, and anyone who was anyone would be there. Only the finest foods would be served, only the best music would be played.
This sounds great. What was with that warning you put up before? I want to go here now.
So LaLaurie, she prided herself on being an excellent host. She tended to the needs of her guests. She was considered one of the most beautiful and intelligent women in New Orleans. And anyone who met her could not stop talking about her. But that was the side of her she let people see.
Ooh.
Under this facade, LaLaurie was a heartless, sadistic, and quite possibly insane woman. So, as was common, you're just laughing.
I laugh when I'm nervous.
You should be. So, as was common at the time, Lalaurie was in possession of many slaves. So, obviously, it would be through their hard efforts that she hosted the parties that she did.
Right, thank you. Yeah. Credit where credit's due.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, obviously, I mean, having slaves is just not a good thing.
No.
But Madame Lalaurie took it to another level. She was beyond cruel. There seemed to be a large number of new slaves constantly coming to the mansion, leading to whispers about what was happening in the house. Parlour maids were replaced without explanation. The stable boy just disappeared.
Oh, no.
One night, a neighbour heard a scream and went to investigate. They claimed to have seen Lalaurie furiously chasing a young slave out across the balcony with a whip in her hand.
Oh, God.
So, unfortunately, the slave slipped over the rail and fell to her death. Actually, the one account says that she jumped. She purposely threw herself off the roof. It was actually, there was a law in place at the time in the city. It was unlawful to treat slaves cruelly. You had to be decent about it. Like, you keep slaves, which it seems hypocritical, really. No, you can keep slaves.
You're allowed to own as many human beings as you want, but you have to feed them and let them live in your house.
Yes.
Right. Oh, God.
So, as a result, after this incident, authorities took many of the slaves away from Lalaurie to be sold at auction. Unfortunately, she was able to get relatives to buy back most of the slaves for her in secret.
Oh, she's a horrible human being. The idea of a slave auction too, by the way, just, you know, what price can I get on this healthy young 22-year-old human?
It's just disgusting.
Sorry, go on.
So everything really, truly came to light, the true nature of Madame Lalaurie, on April 10th, 1834. A fire broke out from the kitchen, quickly spread through the house, and firefighters arrived to put out the blaze. They found the cook in the kitchen, a 70-year-old woman, chained to the stove.
Oh, my God.
She claimed she had set the fire on purpose as a suicide attempt in fear of being taken to the uppermost room of the house, a place that she claimed no one ever comes back from. So, looking at the firefighters, they were looking to ensure that everyone had been evacuated, so they, well, we have to go up to this room. They went upstairs and they noticed a strange barred door leading to this room. What they found behind this door was a sickening sight. So, the New Orleans Bee newspaper reported the next morning, they said in the paper, "Upon entering, the most appalling spectacle met their eyes. Seven slaves, more or less horribly mutilated, were seen suspended by the neck with their limbs apparently stretched and torn from one extremity to the other."
Oh my God.
"Language is powerless and inadequate to give a proper conception of the horror which a scene like this must have inspired. We shall not attempt it, but leave it rather to the reader's imagination to picture what it was."
Don't do that. My imagination's really powerful.
So, essentially, the walls were lined with bodies of slaves, some dead, some still living. These bodies were mutilated.
Some still living.
There were still living people in this uppermost room.
Oh, my God.
Their bodies were mutilated and operated on. Her husband was a surgeon. So, these people were sick. Word quickly spread and the community was outraged by the atrocity. Like, obviously, they expected you not to treat your slaves cruelly. So this was still outrageous. This was not acceptable. A mob started to form and they wanted to chase them out of the city. Lalaurie and her husband managed to escape by the skin of their teeth, riding on a horse-drawn carriage towards the Mississippi River, being pursued by the angry mob. Nobody saw the couple again. Some believe they moved to northern Louisiana. Others say they immigrated to France. This is probably the most likely scenario, as there's several claims that Lalaurie died in Paris, but the circumstances and specifics of her death are unclear.
Okay.
During repairs in the late 1800s, workers found skeletons buried under the floorboards.
Oh, my God.
They believed to be remains of slaves that Lalaurie murdered, explaining why there was a constant number of new slaves coming to the mansion.
Oh, my God.
So, the mansion went through a number of owners. It was used as a public high school, a music school.
Oh, no, great idea. Yeah, no. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm all behind that. Yeah.
a public high school.
That leaves such a bad taste in my mouth.
Let's use the murder house as a high school. That'll be great for the kids.
No, not that one, Marge. That's the murder house.
So it was a public high school. It was a music school, a bar, a furniture store, a refuge for young delinquents, a high-class restaurant. I'm glad you're laughing because it really it helps to boost the mood.
Some of those fit and some of them don't. No. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can sell it with a bar. Like, you can be drunk at 3 in the morning. The bartender goes, oh, yeah, no, no, people were murdered here. They're still buried in the floorboards. That's awesome, man. It's so cool. That does not fly as a high-class restaurant.
No.
That's not what I want to be hearing.
No.
What's that rising smell coming from the floorboards? Probably the generations of dead slaves buried beneath the house. Fondant?
Ignore the smell.
Would Monsieur like to see the wine list?
You detect an odor of death. So many of these owners reported incidents which they claim could only be caused by the spirit of Madame Lalaurie herself and the slaves that she tortured.
Mm.
People have reported hearing painful screams coming from the house when it was empty, when it was unoccupied, late at night. There have been many sightings of apparitions walking on the balcony and in the yards. Owners and tenants never seem to stay at the property for very long.
Because it smells of dead bodies.
Sure, they cleaned it. They actually refurbished the whole thing in the late 1800s.
Oh, sorry, you did say that, yeah.
So the mansion constantly seemed to keep changing hands.
Yep.
At one point, Madame Lalaurie was spotted leaning over a baby's crib.
Oh.
Other times, her spirit was apparently much more violent. In the late 19th century, a sleeping servant was awoken abruptly when he found himself being strangled by the spirit of Lalaurie.
Oh, no.
He claimed a pair of black hands broke the grip of Lalaurie, who then screamed and vanished. Perhaps it was the spirit of a slave intervening.
Sure. Well, they, at this point, they outnumber her by quite a margin.
Yes.
So I.
But they probably did in life as well, and they still, unfortunately, had some pretty...
That's a power dynamic
argument,
though, isn't it? Anyway, okay.
So
none of this, James, is very fun.
No, it's not. I'm glad that you're helping to keep it a little bit light because it is pretty grim.
It's a self-defense mechanism. Yeah.
It's really fascinating, but it is quite grim.
Mm.
So the spirits of the slaves have also been seen in the house, but they've never acted violently. At one time, like I said, the mansion was a boarding house. A man came home after a day's work and began to climb the steps to go to his room. And there on the stairs, he sees an African-American man who's completely naked. Except for chains and shackles.
Oh, hello. Oh, never mind. Sorry, that last bit ruined that completely.
So he had chains and shackles tied around him.
Yeah.
When he
Well, I suppose if you're into that, though.
So
the get back on track. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So he went to reach out and offer this man some help. When he did, the figure just vanished. Disappeared.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
When the mansion was a furniture store, the owner suspected vandals were breaking in. He constantly found his furniture ruined, coated...
That's another one that doesn't fit. That must be the nicest looking furniture store in the world, not just in Louisiana. Like, you're saying this is like an 18th century mansion?
It's a really fancy mansion.
Right. So you'd be selling
like a Creole style. Yeah.
Yeah. So you'd be selling fancy as hell. You're not selling flat packs.
No.
That place, are you?
They didn't open a mini IKEA.
That's immediately what I was thinking. Yeah. And then just the whole lower level. And then upstairs in the murder room is where you buy all of your little candles and stuff. You know,
all the stuff that you skip right at the end.
Exactly. The you're running because you're sick of it. I've been here for an hour. I've got the flat pack number I wanted and I just
I can see the really cool trolleys that they got. I'm just going to grab one and get out of here.
Do I stay back and get meatballs? Not from this IKEA.
No. So he constantly found his furniture ruined, coated in some sort of dark, stinking liquid. Stinking liquid. I'm doing really well.
Ecto. Was that English?
Yes, it was.
Ectoplasm. So, ectoplasm.
Exactly. He stayed. He decided he's going to stay up one night with a shotgun. that's the way to deal with this. Hoping the vandals would show up again.
Great.
No one entered the building. Because
there's a guy sitting in there with a shotgun.
But in the morning, the furniture was ruined again.
Huh.
And the man promptly closed up shop.
Yep, I would too. Smart move.
So more recently, a computer technician was visiting a friend who was living in the mansion. I believe at this point it was serving as luxury apartments. Because of course
it was. Yeah.
So the technician is working on his friend's computer and he hears this loud banging sound. This.
Can I just... I was drawing on my run sheet and I wasn't looking at you at all. And then you banged on the table for the first time and I've actually pooed my pants.
So that's essentially what would have happened to this guy. So he looks up. He sees a picture frame lifting itself up off the wall.
To hell with your picture frame. You scared the crap out of me with that slam on the table. Sorry, picture frame.
So this picture frame is lifting itself up off the wall and slamming back down again over and over. And he leaves the mansion. He tells his friend, the next time you need help with your computer, ask somebody else. I am never going back in that house again.
I've had bad IT guys in different jobs before, but never that bad.
Have you tried turning it off and back on again?
That's right. Also, by the way, I think your photo frames have malware.
So, rather recently, actually, the mansion has had a famous owner.
Oh, no. Yeah. Who is it?
Nicolas Cage.
Oh,
bought the mansion back in 2007 for $3 million.
That creepy bastard, he would. He so would.
He bought the house in 2007 for $3,450,000.
Yep.
For this mansion.
Okay, yeah, I've run the numbers, and yeah, that's entirely too much to pay for a haunted mansion. Yeah.
But Nicolas Cage could afford that. Yeah.
Nicolas Cage is a time-traveling vampire, isn't he?
Probably.
We've all seen those photos online. Yeah. Yep, go on.
So he had plans to write a great American horror novel while living in the house, hoping to find inspiration there.
Again, of course he did. So nothing surprises me with Nicolas Cage anymore.
The story that was recounted to me is that Cage returned to the mansion after a night out with some friends. The next morning, they tried to check if he was all right. He must have got blind drunk, I guess. So they're trying to check if he's all right, but they couldn't get a hold of him. So they went to the mansion. All the lights were off through the window. And I've looked through this window. See the staircase coming down. Through the window, they could see Cage sitting on the stairs, pale white.
Yeah.
He wasn't responding to their knocking on the door, so they had to break it open and carry him out of the house.
Really?
Yeah. So in interviews, Cage seems very blasé about his experience. He doesn't seem to mention this incident, so the story could just be made up.
Sure.
Part of doing the ghost tours in New Orleans.
Yeah, and it benefits him as well because it's another added element of mythos. And
so Nicolas Cage, though, he does have a love of voodoo. And he actually...
Really?
Yeah. So he had a pyramid built in New Orleans in the same cemetery as voodoo priestess Marie Laveau.
Okay.
And he plans to be buried there. Some speculate
he's such a weird guy.
He really
is. He's so weird.
So some speculate he did this because he thinks he's been cursed by LaLaurie and hopes that Marie Laveau will uncurse him.
Right.
And so he sold the mansion in 2009. Again, it doesn't stay with anybody for very long. And shortly after selling the mansion, he built this pyramid in the cemetery.
Why a pyramid?
I don't know. What's National treasure?
Yep, sorry, go on. No, that's all I need. Yep.
But so, I mean, there have been some very bizarre occurrences in this house. I mean, I want to ask you, are you convinced that the LaLaurie Mansion is haunted by the spirit of Madame LaLaurie and her slaves?
No. I am such a skeptic. I am fascinated by... And again, I go back to my original point. Yes. I am fascinated by this and these stories, and that is a truly awful story you just told me. It's really scary and gross and makes me feel very uncomfortable. But to me, the fascination in that is, okay, well, what's caused all of those things?
Yes. I mean, I guess given that your answer is no, I do... I'm not saying I... I'm convinced myself.
Oh, but if I said yes, you and I would have just been staring at each other going, I know, right? It's so haunted. Of course it is. Right.
And we're
agreeing with each other.
Let's discuss, what... How would you explain some of these spooky, haunting-like...
I'd say a lot of it, so the sightings, from what I've read and understand, a lot of it is that power of suggestion that I talked about before. So if you move into a place and you even hear the story... that, literally possibly hundreds of black slaves were all murdered here. Any little daydream about a black person all of a sudden becomes a ghost of a slave.
Okay.
You know, that's in your subconscious. You wake up in the middle of the night. Dreams, we've had dreams that feel real. Everyone's had a dream that's felt real. I once had a dream that I sat and failed my exam at university once. That was not a fun dream to wake up from.
I thought you were going to say that was not a dream in the end.
No, perfect record from exams. All barely passed. Yeah, very happy to say on all of them.
I mean, I guess there could have been a breeze come through lifting the frame off the
wall.
The
photo frame's harder to explain, but just something being harder to explain doesn't mean it's unexplainable.
Yes.
But that still makes it interesting.
I guess the thing that makes these stories fascinating is that... There isn't an explanation yet.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, God, you've convinced me that this woman is a horrible human being, and if there's a hell, she should be in it. I really want to know more about her, the story of her. Well,
I think you need to make a trip to New Orleans.
For other reasons.
For many reasons.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
It's a very fascinating place.
Mardi Gras, bring it on. Okay. Well,
what are you talking about?
Mine is...
Light and fluffy.
No, it's not. Okay. It's not. And mine is wholly unsatisfying too. I'll throw it out there. Like, I'm going to try and convince you as to my theory on this.
Okay.
And I'm going to try and win you around to my side of it. But ultimately, this is a mystery that is not explained to this day. Okay?
Okay.
It's widely called the Dyatlov Pass incident. You've never heard of this before, have you?
No.
It's quite a famous thing, especially amongst conspiracy theorists. And it occurred during the Soviet era in Russia. So immediately there's links to KGB and CIA operatives and all this sort of stuff. You know,
okay.
It just lends itself naturally to conspiracy stuff. So to give you the background, the Dyatlov Pass incident occurred on February 2nd, 1959, deep in the Cold War era. The area in which the incident took place is named Dyatlov Pass in honor of the group's leader Igor Dyatlov. When someone is a leader and the name is Igor, the title is
Lidor.
It's Ligor, yeah, yep. Straight away, you know, like father for a priest. It's, you know, I'm Ligor. I've labored this joke too long now. I just made an ass of myself. The incident has spawned several books, hundreds of websites and conspiracy theories, and even a horror movie called Devil's Pass, which IMDb gives a 5.7.
Delightful.
Correct.
Fun for the whole family.
Correct response for that grading out of 10. Yeah. So in February of 1959, 10 experienced hikers from the Ural Polytechnic Institute, so a technical university in Russia, set about hiking Dead Mountain.
Dun, dun, dun.
In the Ural Mountains. According to author Keith McCloskey. McCloskey? I do get some of the good names. No, you won with names this week with...
Madame Delphine Lallery.
Lallery, thank you.
And Leonard Lallery. Lewis Nicholas Lallery.
That's, yeah, you've
Nicholas Cage.
What have I... what have I come with? I've come with McCloskey. McCloskey's okay. Who wrote a book called Mountain of the Dead. So he's dedicated a big punch of his life to going to... He's actually been there. He's interviewed people that researched this and people that were... actually there investigating this incident, and it's it gets really interesting. So according to him, the local people, the Mountsi people, they're like an indigenous people that live in the Ural Mountains. They don't identify as Russian or Soviet or anything.
Okay.
Mountsi people. They have a culture of just naming most, if not all, landforms in their world. So to give this mountain a name, firstly, does not make it special. Like the very next mountain's got a name and the valley under it's got a name. And the name Dead Mountain might just be a bit of a mistranslation.
Okay,
so
yeah.
What they might mean by Dead Mountain is like desolate mountain. There's nothing up there. Very few trees. It's sort of past the tree line after a point. Very few animals live up there. There's just sort of nothing there, basically,
okay.
You know, except for 10 tourists that want to hike it, you know. The Mountsi did warn these 10 travelers not to visit the mountains, but this might have just been locals warning outsiders to get out of their backyard. There's nothing up there. What do you want to do? Can you stop bothering us, please? Can you get out of our town? You know,
get stop off my lawn.
Stop going to gift shops and buying our hats and wearing them ironically is what we're trying to say. You know, don't go home wearing a T-shirt with our prints on it and thinking you're cultured is what they're trying to say. So the incident involved these 10 hikers who were undergoing a hike to meet university requirements. They're all studying some form of outdoor education. They ranged in age from their early 20s. The eldest member of the group was 39 at the time. He's very much an outlier. Most of them were between 22 and about 26.
Okay.
The one guy who was over 30 was he fought in the First World War, had run a whole different types of jobs. He'd worked as a security guard at different points. He's really the outlier because of his age. One of them, Yuri Yudin, was the only survivor of this trip, only because he never hiked the mountain. He got sick. He had some sort of a nerve problem with his extremities and ended up having to get on a train and go home.
Wow.
After 2 weeks of no news from the hikers, a search party was eventually set. And when the hikers were found, No one could explain what the hell happened up at that mountain. Now, let me paint a bit of a scene for you, okay? What they found were all of them dead. Not one of those hikers, not one of the nine that ended up on the mountain survived. They were all found in strange conditions, strange places, and even stranger stages of undress. Many were not wearing appropriate clothing for hiking up the mountain. And by that, I mean they found at least two just in underwear.
Okay.
They found signs that a lot of them had been out at night in no shoes or socks. There were even signs that many of them had actually stolen clothing from others. They were wearing mismatched items of clothing. Several of them had significant injuries to their body, but nothing outwardly. It actually looked as though one of the investigators described it as though they'd been hit by a car or a truck because their ribs were so badly broken and their inside organs were so badly messed up.
I just want to say, I mean, other than the death, this sounds like the aftermath of one of my parties. Stages of undress, mishmash clothing, bizarre...
Broken ribs.
Bizarre injuries.
They found, the only signs of any sort of distress or struggle apart from these injuries were at least two of them, including Dyatlov, the leader, had bruising on their knuckles, like suggestions they'd been in some sort of a physical altercation. But that could have also just been them surviving the elements. You know, when you fall over and you sort of put your hands out to stop yourself, it could have been them putting balled out fists down to stop themselves from falling. No real satisfactory explanation exists. The official report that was given to the coroner was that they had been affected by some sort of and I haven't actually got this written down, I've researched this a fair bit, some natural force as yet unidentified. That's what's listed in official Soviet documents. They've actually wrote down, we don't know, something happened to them. And they're
That's
all
helpful.
Dead. Yeah. Gets worse. At least two of the hikers were found without eyes. No eyes in their skull. And importantly, when they left, when they set out, they definitely had eyes.
Okay.
Bodies were found without them. One of them was found without a tongue. No tongue. Like the tongue had
like
either
chopped
been...
off. At, like
reports vary, and this is sort of what's hard with this whole thing too, because it was at an era. It was during an era of really high secrecy, and the Soviets were notorious back then for not wanting any of their vulnerabilities known to the world. So if they made any sort of mistake, they didn't want the Americans to know about it. They wanted to save face. So for 10 people to go missing in the heart of Russia at that time, that's bad press. So a lot of the reports, that you can find the reports if you research it. And there's a big call nowadays for there's no statute of limitation on these sort of things. It's just Russian government, release the files. We want the truth on this, please.
We want
all the evidence we can. So a lot of the evidence we have come from amateur researchers, people that were there at the time investigating it. So when we say she's missing a tongue, it could have been chopped off, could have been sawn off, it could have been bitten off, the details.
Okay.
What we do know, we can say, and where it gets a bit grim, autopsies revealed that there was blood in her stomach, which means that the tongue was removed while she was alive. When they found the bodies, two of them were found together, lying next to each other, with severe burns on their feet and hands. What they believe had happened is that they'd started a fire to try to stave off hypothermia. And because they're already in the throes of it, you immediately, not immediately, but you eventually lose feeling to your hands and feet. So they could have been trying to get so close to that tiny fire, they actually burnt the soles of their feet and their palms. Items of clothing that probably belonged to these two men were then found later on other victims. So they've actually cannibalized clothing off of the weaker ones. Two of them were found in a corpse of trees like that with burnt feet. Four of them were all found together in a small ravine, sort of a small dip in the hill. These were the ones that were found with the severe injuries.
Okay.
The one with missing tongue, broken ribs. Three of them, the remaining three, were found leading back up the hill towards their tent. When they found their tent, it had been caved in under the weight of, mostly under not being used for about a month. It was about a month when they actually found them, found the bodies. But what they did found was that the front of the tent was completely intact. Side walling of the tent, great big slits carved into it.
But like not an animal, some sort of knife
or
something?
No. They found the knife that actually carved it out. The carving marks were made from the inside of the tent.
Okay.
Okay, right? Yeah, so let's paint a bit of a scene here.
But you've been painting a pretty good scene, I think.
Oh, I can go more. I can go deeper into this.
I'm just worried about all those people that skipped over my discussion and jumped right into yours.
Well, we put a warning on the whole episode, frankly. So what we think happened is that they've climbed up the mountain. They're about 300 meters from the peak. Like the very next morning, they would have climbed up to the peak of this mountain. Researchers suggested that they've actually gone along an inhospitable or an inopportune route to get to the top.
Okay.
At some point, they've made a mistake and gone along the wrong path, which is unusual, especially because Dyatlov, the leader, the Ligor, had done that very trek. He'd done this walk the year previously. So he should have known the right route to take. He should have known where to lead them. So them being 300 feet below the peak, it's a really bad place to camp the night. They're very exposed. They're far too close to the top. It's too cold. Nine of them are huddled together in one tent for warmth. So already this expedition is not doing well. Okay. At some point in the night, something has affected the group. Something has terrified them. Something has attacked them. Something has reached out to them. Enough for one of the members. In fact, and this is, again, no official documentation is clear on this, but amateur researchers, some of them have claimed that the slits indicate that they were small at first and then ripped open.
Okay.
Almost as though someone has opened up a vantage point within the tent to look out of and then eventually torn open and they've all fled the tent. Gets even weirder. The tracks that they found, they were pretty good at finding the tracks and the movements of these people because nothing's up at this point of the mountain. So your footfalls in the snow just sort of freeze in place and they only get covered up by fresh snow, a little bit of scraping away and you can find people's tracks pretty clearly. It looks as though they fled in single file out of the tent back down the hill. That's where they find the first two bodies who are lying virtually nude in just sort of underwear, laying together. Like they wouldn't have, it's an unnatural pose. They would have died together and then been laid down next to each other, which implies the rest of the group were with them when they died. The remaining four further down the hill were then found in this ravine. I don't know about you, but if I'm in distress and I'm running away from something, you look for some sort of shelter. You want with something at your back so that you can look in one direction. You know, you feel a little bit protected. There's evidence that at least one of them climbed a tree at some point.
Yeah.
Either to get a vantage point or to get fresh branches to build a fire with. We're not too sure. But they're the ones that are really, really interesting because they're the ones, like I said, suffering the really severe internal injuries. The missing tongue, the missing eyes, the broken ribs, the bruised up knuckles. Those four are all found relatively together in that ravine. The next three are then found in varying positions on a separate path leading back up the mountain. The best theory states that whatever's happened down in that ravine, these three are now in such desperate states that they're willing to risk going back further up the mountain, back into the bad weather, back up the cold, completely ill-equipped to make that steep hike again to get to the only shelter they were guaranteed, which was the tent, to get back to some sort of clothing, maybe some food. They also had basic weaponry. From everything I've read, they had knives and they had torches and stuff like that. So all of their survival gear is still back up in that tent. So the question remains, what makes a group of nine people so terrified that they're willing to leave their shelter in the middle of the night, run downhill into the wilderness to freeze to death? Most of them were found frozen to death, even the ones with internal injuries. They could have survived if they were found. Don't know about the person with the tongue and the missing eyes. We can't quite explain that. And then what event happens further down the mountain that is so traumatic people are willing to go back to the place they originally fled from? Yeah,
tell
creepy.
Us your theory.
It's
that's
well.
Here.
So my theory on this, there was a couple that I worked to. Now let's just rule out a couple of the really obvious stuff first up. Okay, so people try to argue that there was an avalanche, or that they could hear the rumblings of an avalanche. When you're that far up a mountain, avalanches actually aren't that great a threat.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's thin snowfall up the top. It's actually further down the slopes on, there's about a 20% incline, I think is where I remember reading avalanches. You'd think I'd be prepared and have it in front of me, James. I'm not. And you don't want to be down the bottom where an avalanche sort of builds and rolls yes. and becomes the wave. Up a certain point, there's less of a risk of that. You're more likely to see an avalanche below you. So that can be ruled out. Plus, the tent was relatively intact. It had been fallen down just because of weather and yep. misuse, but they found it pretty easily. If it was an avalanche, it would have been buried completely. So that pretty well rules that out. Plus, they're experienced hikers. They would have known about avalanches. Wild animals, there really were none. Yep. None of the bodies were touched or molested in any way.
Yep.
So if it was wild animals they were running from, firstly, that pack of wolves must have been starving to chase down 9 people. They would do it. There's cases of it happening. But then not eat the bodies? Only eat the eyes out and the tongue? Doesn't make sense. Same with a bear. Just doesn't make sense. Involvement, immediately the Mounsi people, the indigenous people, were blamed. Straight away.
Okay, yes.
That makes no sense at all. The Mounsi people had modern technology. They had guns. You know, if they wanted them dead, they would have just waited till they're up in the mountain, killed them all, and then taken all their stuff. All of their stuff was still in the tent.
Yeah.
Whatever attacked them or scared them had no interest in their belongings.
So what was it?
What was it, James? There is a theory stated that, and this is endorsed in by a couple of different sources that were around at the time, light orbs. What are described as orbs of light were spotted flying over those regions of the Ural Mountains. The Mounsi people have got claims about seeing them. People within nearby villages have seen these orbs of light floating through the air. There are also several military bases around that area. Again, peak of the Soviet Empire, peak of the Cold War. Any kind of country area, the Soviets would put some sort of a military barracks there because it's large open space, a huge yep. employer for the local people. No scheduled missile or test launches were made that night. So these orbs of light are not military. My theory is that they were visited by someone that we don't fully understand. Let's leave it at that.
Aliens.
Oh, well, yeah, just come out and say it and ruin the vibe of it. Oh, okay. Oh, I'm trying to be dramatic, James. E.T. floats down in some sort of a craft, some sort of orbiting craft.
Did they have Reese's Pieces in their tent?
Look, if you're not going to take this seriously, I just don't know. Possibly. So a theory that I've sort of come up with from reading all of this is that they spot these light sources drifting over top through the canvas of the tent. They hear a noise and they see a light deep in the middle of the night on this cold mountaintop after they're stressed, they're cold. Already they've gone the wrong way. They're too high up the mountain. Eventually, they notice that these light sources are very bright above them and they can hear them traveling over the top. So one of them takes out his pocket knife, carves a little slit in the side of the tent. Bear in mind, this is pre-plastic zips on tents. I've seen pictures of these tents. It's the old proper wraparound canvas jobs
where you okay.
tie it off around the button and then a sheet of canvas goes over the top. They're actually really hard to open quickly. So he's cut open a little slit to sort of peek outside. Already they must be pretty paranoid, willing to affect their shelter like that to poke outside. They notice that they're surrounded by these lights. And then a larger deafening boom or a large bright light invades the tent and they all panic as one, ripping open the side of the tent and running out. You can imagine if it's one exit point of this tent, that they all just stream through it as one. If they notice that they're surrounded then, they're not going to deviate too much from the path and they're going to follow the person in front of them. That sort of herd mentality.
Yeah.
If you're surrounded and you spot the same exit point as the other person, you follow that exit person. They run down the hill. They find shelter in this copse of trees. Eventually, the light sources go away and they realize, oh no, this is like 2 a.m. I'm still in my underwear. I only managed to grab a jacket before I ran out. She's not wearing a bra. We're all wearing blankets. We're going to freeze out here. Who brought shoes and socks? Really? No one? I'm starting a fire. So they start a little fire. Already they're starting to feel the effects of hypothermia. They're probably already paranoid, terrified, half asleep. Two of the guys managed to burn their feet
yep.
on the little fire they've managed to make. These are the guys that are wearing the least amount of clothing to begin with.
Yep.
They're already struggling in the cold. 9 of them all huddled together. Maybe the lights then come back. Roaming back over the top of the hill. They were spotted drifting over the landscape a couple of times in the night, making erratic movements. They see that. 2 of the guys are already pretty well toast. They take and they scavenge what clothes they can offer them and set out down the hill. And finally, they find this little ravine. To me, that's a last stand kind of juncture. That's a place where you set up where you're either going to fight and survive it or you're going to last out the night kind of place. Obviously, they didn't. I can't explain the missing tongue. I'd love to be able to explain the missing tongue. That's the bit that keeps me up at night. What makes a woman just bite her tongue off?
If she did it.
If she did it. Who knows? Maybe these aliens are really big on Frenching. They just don't understand the whole concept of it.
How it all works. The tongue with you.
Maybe. Maybe they did. Maybe they took it as a test specimen. Who knows? So they're all found dead in the ravine. The last three are terrified. They know the only shelter they've got
so they've gone back to the tent. Yep.
They're found staggered points down the hill. So they've just set out. Like one starts running, the other one starts going after it, the other one starts going after them. They are all so tired and exhausted. They were found in positions where they were basically crawling on their hands and knees to get up the mountain, which means one gets further ahead, the other one slows down a little bit, the other one slows down a little bit. The gap widens between them, and they all eventually freeze to death in the snow. James, considering there was no scheduled flights in that area, and yet there were bright lights in the sky, considering there were no creatures around that could have caused this, considering we can pretty well rule out foul play from the local people, the only other people for miles around, have I convinced you that whatever affected and terrified and chased off these people is something of another world, something maybe of another planet or another universe?
Well, you said there were no scheduled tests.
Oh, is that the sticking point?
No.
You can't trust those crafty Russians.
I really don't know that I could attribute it to aliens. I
know, far-fetched, right? Yeah.
It's a crazy, creepy story, and I don't have an explanation. Like we said, this is one of the fascinating things about these stories is sometimes they just don't have a very, very clear explanation.
Yeah.
I think something scared the hell out of them.
Yeah. And putting my pragmatic hat on and getting rid of that line of thought there, I'm with you. What scared them? What terrified them to the point where they're willing to leave that shelter? And what I didn't get into too is how do you get that sort of bruising? Like, did they fall out of a tree and land on it? There'd be bruising.
Yeah.
There was no bruising. There was no obvious marks. There was no obvious cuts or lacerations. And they were saying it looked as though from the inside that they'd been hit by a car.
Yeah. It is a very bizarre situation, but I don't know that I would attribute it to aliens. I'm sorry.
That's fine. That's okay. I'm with you. Okay, well, we're nil from nil in this episode. We're doing okay.
Yeah, we're just flat on that one. What did everybody else think, though? What did you think? Aliens attack these hikers. Where was it, sorry?
Dyatlov Pass in the Ural Mountains.
Dyatlov Pass. What do you think? Do you think that Lullary Mansion is haunted? Have you experienced anything of a haunting or supernatural nature? We would love to hear it.
Even if it's just something you can't explain.
Please let us know in the comments on any of our social media accounts.
They are on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.
At Are You Convinced is the Twitter and Instagram.
Thank you.
Yes. And then
Episode 6, I should be getting this right by now. You throw it at me every week and I always have to look at the run sheet.
So Facebook is www.facebook.com/areyouconvinced.podcast.
What topic are we doing next week, James?
So next week, we've actually decided to do something a little bit different. We're going to do a begrudging convince.
Can you explain to me and the listeners, mostly to me, what is a begrudging convince, James?
So normally each week, we pick what we're going to talk about, the topic that we're going to discuss and convince the other person on. Mm-hmm. But this time, we're going to put some things in a hat. We're going to draw out of that hat, and that's our topic.
That's right. We actually have a physical hat here in front of us.
We'll take a photo to prove it to you.
It'll be on our Instagram account.
The topic is polarizing musicians. So we're going to pull out of the hat the name of a musician or band that has some sort of disdain amongst general audiences.
And amongst the pair of us.
Yes. And we're going to have to convince the other that maybe they're a decent musician, I guess.
Maybe there's something in there that's worth paying attention to.
All right. So let's get into it. This is being drawn live right here.
Am I going
right
first?
Right now. You're going first.
No, I'm so nervous. Okay. Is this what I'm arguing?
This is what you're arguing. You have to convince me on this person.
Okay. I'm going to have to convince James that... Oh, you're joking.
What'd you get?
You're not going to believe it. I'm going to have to convince you, James, that Nickelback has some redeeming features.
Yes. That's fantastic.
No, it's not. That's okay. Oh, okay. All right.
I'm actually equally terrified now. It's so fun to laugh.
There's actually a couple of worse ones in there than Nickelback.
It's easy to laugh at somebody else drawing the names out, but then when it's right in front of you, I don't know what it is. Oh, okay. My convince is not too bad. It's the Jonas Brothers.
I definitely feel like I've come off worse in this one. Some of the, in case you're wondering, some of the other ones that we put in there were Insane Clown Posse, ICP, Nicki Minaj, Justin Bieber was, yeah.
So next week, we are talking polarizing musicians. I am pitching the Jonas Brothers.
And I'm pitching Nickelback, one of my least favorite bands in the world.
We really hope you enjoyed this week's episode. We hope you check out next week's, and you can suggest your topic. As always, please convince your friends to listen.
Absolutely. Yep. Get on to friends, family. Send us a like, send us a comment, send us a tweet, please.
And all of the things.
And we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, we'll catch you then. Thanks, guys.